In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Tortoise. Hello, welcome to Trendy from Tortoise. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis.
This week we're looking at dating, love, and marriage. Britain's very first Lonely Heart advert is believed to have appeared in the late 17th century in a magazine called A Collection for Improvement of Husbandry and Trade. A gentleman of around 30 was seeking a, quote, good young gentlewoman that has a fortune of £3,000 or thereabouts. I put this into an inflation calculator and it appears to have been quite a substantial fortune that he wanted, around £800,000 in today's money.
He might be short of finding people today, let alone back then. Anyway, let's fast forward 300 plus years, and Lonely Hearts have seemingly gone the way of the dinosaurs. Anyway, when I was young, many, many years ago, most people met their future wives and husbands through school, work, or maybe at a party. Now, you're as likely as not to meet your partner via a dating app as you are in a pub or a party. Now, given that spring has traditionally been a time when people got married and with the weather finally warming up at least a bit, we thought that this week we would look at the dating scene today. How and when people form long-term relationships, how has it changed over time?
Now, John and I quite often play two different generations in this podcast, but we thought today, given the change in dating, we needed three generations to adequately explain what's going on. So I'm delighted to say we're joined by one of Trendy's producers, Rebecca Moore. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Hello, I'm here for the youth. Proud to be here. Yeah.
Rebecca is going to play the part of someone in their 20s, which she is. John, am I allowed to say, is playing the part of someone in his 70s?
Which just. Just, Rachel.
I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm not going to say exactly where in the middle I am.
Ah, she's being coy.
I'm being coy.
This is uncharacteristic of you, Rachel. Uncharacteristic, if I may say so. Anyway, so we're going to start this conversation by talking about changes in how relations were or are formed across the three different generations we've just been talking about, because our experiences of those generations are very, very different. And then, in a new innovation for our podcast, we have our own new poll on dating and relationships to talk about. But first, how the formation of relationships changed over time. Now, Rachel, you've dug up some very interesting statistics on what we might call the sexual history of women before they got married and how this has changed over time.
So if you were someone like John, who got married in, I think, the end of the 1970s. Is that right, John?
1978, right.
1978. Then if you look at women, for which we have some longitudinal data in the US and in the UK, the majority, over 60%, would have had no lovers before they got married, or only the person they were getting married to. So if you weren't a virgin at marriage, certainly it was only your husband that you'd ever been with. Fast forward a few decades to the decade where I got married, that was way, way down to 33% of women, so about a third, who had only had one partner or none before marriage. And the majority will have played the field a little bit more. I'm finding this really hard to know what metaphors I'm allowed to use here. I'm very, very worried about causing offence, but let's go with it. And one of the interesting things I thought is, because it gets kind of the online dating question, is in the 1970s, 2% at least admitted to having 10 or more partners before marriage. Now it is 18%, nearly one in five. So the life of women before they got married, their experience, the number of people that they'd been with, has changed very, very substantially. And that's partly, John, I think, a function of age. We are older when we get married, as well as culture.
Very, very much so. Something you and I have talked about before. But again, if we go back to the folk back in the 1970s, average age for a first-time marriage was actually 23 for women. A lot of women have only just got themselves out of university at that age, and 25 for men. And yes, and the first baby usually arrived pretty soon thereafter, within a couple of years. By 2016, in contrast, so not that so long ago, position very different. The average age of women at first birth, now up to 29, gone up by 4 years, but the average age at marriage has gone up even more. Actually, the average age at marriage is now higher than the average age at first birth. And that, of course, tells us an awful lot about the fact that people are now much more likely to have children outside of what we used to call wedlock. Indeed, nearly around a half of all births in the UK are now in that position. But now the average age of women when they actually get married is now actually, you know, 30 plus. So we are in a very, very different world. So women are delaying marriage, though not necessarily perhaps delaying relationships quite as long as this. But the truth is that both seem now to take longer than they once did. And of course, some people now, particularly those in their mid-20s, a large proportion of them, actually around 70% of them, who are actually in a couple, are actually cohabiting rather than actually being married.
And I guess one other difference, John, between your generation and mine, before we bring in Rebecca, is the wedding itself. My parents got married in 1970 in my grandmother's garden. I don't think it costs very much. I think the average expenditure then was about £1,000 in today's money for a wedding. I don't know about yours, whether it was a much grander affair, but certainly now we spend huge amounts of money on our weddings.
Well, my wife and I was a student and my wife was in a part-time employment, so we didn't exactly have a lot of money. Indeed, some people might say we were rather rash by today's standards in getting married when we did. But, you know, that was a different age. And of course, you know, the truth is that particularly, you know, the position of women when they are adults is now so, so different from what it was in my generation. So if we actually go back to, we're now talking, most women are now involved in the labour market. They're involved in the labour market in their 20s. And not only that, a lot of them have been to university and they expect to remain in employment for most of their working lives. And as a result of that, as it were, when you sort of look at the occupational background of men and women when they get married, back in the generation of women born in the 1950s, 38% of them were marrying somebody who, according to the statisticians, was in a higher occupational class than themselves. But that doesn't necessarily reflect difference of social status. It reflects the fact that women's involvement in the labour market was so much less. And certainly once they became married, many of them were going to drop out of the labour market. Now the proportion of women who marry somebody from a different social class is down, a higher social class is down to 16%. Indeed, the majority now are marrying people in the same social class. So more of our relationships that people do eventually form are actually with people in rather similar economic situations. And of course, while getting married is all about love and relationships, it's also an economic contract. And perhaps some of that is also reflected these days in who people decide to partner up with.
I don't know, Rebecca, have you entered wedding season in a big way among your peers yet? Or are you still before that has really hit?
No, my friend, I've only been to one wedding. And I think it's when you're in your 30s, people tell me this wave hits where all your weekends and your annual leave are taken up by weddings.
But my friend, that's when your generation's getting married, if they're going to get married at all.
If they're going to get married, and none of my friends are marriage material, I kid. But really, it's not on the horizon for them. We have one friend in our friendship group who got married at 29. We all thought she was a child bride. Like, we were really shocked. You know, we were all sort of on the wedding day like, are you? I mean, he's lovely, but yeah, not yet.
I suppose one of the interesting things, and we should talk about your experience on online dating before we get to the poll, is that you might assume with the rise of online dating, which is now, as we'll talk about, a very significant part of how people find relationships, that it would increase the amount of social class mixing in relationships, because they're not meeting through university or work, they're meeting through an app that anyone can join. But as John just outlined, that doesn't seem to be what the data is saying. Actually, if anything, the extent to which you're marrying someone of similar educational and professional background to you has increased over the last few decades. Is that your experience? When you look at your friends who are dating online, are they broadly swiping on people who come from relatively similar educational backgrounds to themselves?
I think Rachel is very coyly asking.
I'm trying to be asking very
coyly, Rebecca. But see, I'm a bit more uncouth than her. She's asking very coyly, what are the criteria you use when you use a dating app?
I think it's interesting. So I'm also going to try and be coy for as long as I can before I reveal too much. But the chances that you meet someone who are different to you, that you spark something in a pub, your eyes lock over a band that you really like, all of that sort of falls away. And I think there's nothing more revealing than going onto your friend's dating apps and looking at the swipe history. So, John, before I carry on, have you seen a dating app? Do you know?
No, look. This is a completely foreign world. I mean, as we get to our poll, we talk about, I mean, people in my generation, dating app, what's that? What's about? So you're going to have to explain very slowly for us, Rebecca.
Okay, so the apps online, on your phone, whatever, and you create a profile about yourself, and different apps will ask you for different information. So I'm going to talk about, I think, the more generic one of people my age called Hinge. I don't actually know where the name comes from, but you can input things. That you have to input some photographs, you have to input your age, you have to input your educational background, your religion, your sexuality, and where you live. And you can choose to hide some of those things if you want to, or reveal all.
And you've already told me that you use this not just, as it were, because perhaps you're looking for a date, but actually to look at what your friends are doing online. This sounds almost a bit like Facebook as it does about Hinge,
100%. Facebook, John, is dead. Okay, Facebook is dead. No one meets on Facebook.
Yeah, sure. But it's the same kind of use, right? Yeah. It provides you an opportunity to, you know, find out what your friends are up to. Okay, so I can see there's more interest in this online dating log than I even appreciated.
Well, careful there, because you can't see your friends. You know, my friend is not going to post on the way to go for a burger with my new boo. Like, they're not going to post that. It's when they give you their phones, or when you wrestle their phones off them at a party, you can then go on to their history. So it's very, again, it's revealing. Not that you have to be really close with someone to show, because I think it is revealing. I think you should be a kid in a candy shop, right? You know, really going for it, exploring all the different opportunities. It tends to be you develop a type very early on. I'm revealing much about myself, and they tend to be tell you a lot about what you're looking for without you perhaps realizing it. So I went on a friend's one recently, and they were all financial consultants, all these men. They were all...
Well, that's what all people of your generation are in London. They're either financial consultants or journalists.
John, I despair. Yeah? Both categories are terrible. So she was dating men who were about four...
What about pollsters? What about pollsters, Rebecca? Are they any good?
We love pollsters.
They don't earn enough.
So she was dating men who were a bit older than her, 3 or 4 years older. They often lived in South London, Clapham being the main culprit. And again, this is very London-centric. But
she's looking for marriage material.
Well, she says she's looking for marriage material, okay? And these apps, their sort of catch lines are made to be deleted. So the idea is that you meet someone who shares your same values, or at least you understand something going into them. There's the randomness of meeting someone in real life is stripped out. But I think that's really limiting, and I think that shows, because the app, once it knows that you have a type, will only show you people of that type. So it'll sort of filter it for you. And it's a vicious cycle, John.
The power of algorithms, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Though my experience always with algorithms is that they're always desperate to advertise something when you've already made a purchase, and you kind of go, no, you've got it wrong. I've already made my purchase.
But that's
right?
A perfect metaphor, John, because online dating is in fact an endlessly repeated purchase.
No, but I think my friends would say you have to break the pattern. That's the whole thing. So these apps are not helping me do that. But no, I don't think that people are that adventurous online, Rachel. I think people do look for people who are like them, who they think perhaps there's a a thought about icebreakers. If you go to the same university, if you also like rugby on a Sunday, if you also come from this suburb of, you know, it's all those sort of things which I think people go for without realising it.
All right. So it's the kind of coded social messages that reveal that perhaps this is somebody either not unlike you or at least like somebody whom you think you might like to form a relationship with.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, I mean, what's good and bad about these apps in your experience? I mean, without getting too personal, I mean, have you had good experiences or bad experiences?
Goodness, okay, I'm going to be careful here. So I think the apps came on the scene about 10 years ago and I joined them 7 years ago, I think. And it was so much fun. The novelty of being able to swipe and you swipe right, John. If you don't like them, you swipe left. If you like them, you swipe right. So if you're swiping right on people and then you get an instant match, the endorphin rush from that was a real novelty. It was really fun. You could then go and meet someone that evening if you wanted to. You could meet someone on the weekend who you'd never met before. You didn't know anything about their life. And that was great. Fast forward to the present day. The novelty, I think, for me, has worn off. And I think people went in with such optimism and it was exciting. And now you go in, jar half empty, very cynical. You think it's a vicious cycle where if you don't show yourself too much at the beginning, then that's good. It's a safety commitment. What if you're ghosted? Ghosted, John, is when someone, you go on a date, you think it's gone amazing. You laugh, you talk about their parents. You then on the train home, imagine a whole future together and they never reply. So I think the problem with dating is that the novelty of being able to meet someone who's totally new means that you don't have those social connections to hold them responsible, and yourself as well. You feel like you can just leave without a trace. You don't have their mum. Your mums don't know their mums, and you can't have no responsibility to that person later.
Easy come, easy go.
Exactly. I would like to say that I've never ghosted someone. I have always replied very politely the morning after to say thanks, but no thanks.
So are you still primarily meeting people online, or given what you've just said, are you now becoming an in-person dater?
I think in-person dating is the way forward. I feel in my own personal life, people have been coming to me and saying, oh, I've got this great friend. Have you got anyone who you can recommend? There's a real push to set friends up in real life. People are suggesting going on matchmaking evenings. So people don't want to spend ages chatting online for it to go nowhere. And I think that's what's happening. I actually have not met a single long-term partner on a dating app, I have to confess. And I think a lot of friends are finding that too. But a lot of apps are now gearing towards pushing people to meet in real life. Hinge, for example, after a few days of having matched with someone, will say, are you going to meet up? It will send you a prompt. Are you going to meet up? So I think that's where we're going.
I think one of the things you said about social connections is very interesting, because this is in itself part of a broader trend, in that as we become more of a graduate workforce, as London and the Southeast has become even more dominant economically, there's a good chunk of people who are geographically mobile in a way that wouldn't have been true 50 years ago. And traditionally, dating and marriage would have been in a geographic social group where people are likely to know each other's parents. There are ties, but therefore there are also consequences to behaviour in a way that is probably already diminished very, very substantially simply by living in your case, London, in a lot of cases, people's cases, London, or a big city where those familial connections have gone, but are then reduced even further if they're not even formed through friendship. So, you know, I met my now husband through politics, and I was very, very conscious in the first few dates that we had a lot of friends, and indeed professional friends in common. And if this went wrong, it was going to have consequences beyond the relationship. And that, like, instinctively, that probably makes a difference to how people approach relationships.
Yeah, I think that's true. And also, I think that you probably give people more of a go. You have the slow burn. A lot of people in conversations say they don't have the spark on the first meet. And that's quite a high bar. And you don't get that easy sort of transition in. You don't have an understanding of someone in a context, which is really important, because you might be crap on a first date in a restaurant with a total stranger. And that's fair enough.
Yeah, whereas if it's part of a friendship group, and again, it was true in my case, as it were, you have an opportunity to get to know somebody gradually.
How did you meet your wife? I must ask.
Well, it's very boring, Rebecca. We met in the Bodleian Library, which is the University Library at Oxford.
That's wonderful. That's exactly what I would have expected your answer to be, John. Oh, well, I'm so pleased.
You know, you made sure we are both, we're clearly both managing to live up to our stereotypes.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, you met somebody who was a fellow political anorak, and I met somebody who was equally intellectually interested and interesting.
I guess one other thing we should talk about briefly before we come to the poll is the kind of financial incentives around dating and marriage. So my parents, who also met at Oxford, got married somewhat earlier than I think they would otherwise have done, because Nuffield College in those days offered married people's accommodation. They paid for your flat if you were married.
Yes, absolutely. I also lived in Nuffield.
There has always been quite a clear financial incentive to get married. I think, you know, if we go back more than 100 years, people often got married later, actually, because the man needed to save enough money over time. And there was often a bigger age gap for that reason. For you, sort of generation, Rebecca, if you can speak for them, do you think financial incentives come into play? So one thing anecdotally that a few people in my office have said is renting's a lot cheaper if you're sharing a bedroom. So that might push you into a longer term relationship earlier or make you stick with it a bit longer. On the other hand, women are completely financially independent now. So that might push you in the other direction. What do you observe?
Yeah, a mix of both. So in my own life, I'm very lucky that I live with my oldest friend together in a two bed. Now, we can never move out of this flat because London is not built for people, two people who are not a couple, right? And I've got other friends who were pushed into, I mean, they would say they love their partner, and I believe them. And I think that sometimes it's luck, because in COVID, especially, they thought, I'm going to hedge my bets. I'm just going to pair up with this person. Cost of living crisis then hit. And I think people's attitude towards dating changed. So I had a very frank conversation with a friend who, when I mocked her gently for putting her university and her job, both of which are very good, on her dating profile, I said, oh, you're only going to attract people who care about that sort of stuff. And she said, don't be naive. Getting married might be the second biggest economic event of your life, second to your parents dying. And we have to be aware of that.
Absolutely. And we do know that when you control for education, it's still the case that people are more likely to marry those who come from a similar wealth background to themselves, because that desire, however instinctive, to keep wealth in the dynasty.
Oh, 100%.
Survives through the generation.
I was going to say, again, not to reveal any friends here, but I've got a friend who is on a dating app, which you have to show evidence of your bank accounts. And her minimum filter is $150K a year.
Wow. We'll be back in a moment. First, though, a short break. So, John, how does Rebecca's experience align with what we found in our new poll? Do you want to give the highlights?
Yeah, I would say, actually, Rebecca's probably a bit more sceptical about online dating than our polling suggests. I mean, I think, you know, The first thing that we should say is that, I mean, of the people who've used them, and we'll come to how many people use them in a moment, about 55% say they're very or fairly satisfied with the service they used. And that figured up to 62% if we take those in our sample who are actually now currently married or in a relationship. So there's probably, therefore, a bit of a link there. And that also people would say that, for the most part, they think the service is reasonably good. Thing that's surprising for me, right? Old codger as I am, right? Okay. So in my generation, we ask people whether they ever used a dating app. Less than 10% of over 65s have ever used a dating app, and it isn't that much higher for 55s to 64s. Although, interestingly, I mean, my nearest acquaintance with dating apps is, I follow the Archers, right? And there is a character in the Archers called Alistair, who was once married to Shula Archer, but she divorced him. But he was also on a dating app, and the point was he was beginning to make contact with people on a dating app while at the same time being caught in this potential relationship with his veterinary assistant who's married. So, you know, the point is, most people, in his case, he's been divorced, and so therefore he's looking for another partner. But now, the thing, however, one needs to realise, for the under under 35s, we're talking about nearly 3 in 5, 58% have used a dating app at some point in their lives. And by the way, you're Rachel's generation, 35 to 44, even that group, it's nearly a half who've used a dating app. So you might be in the half that didn't, but there's another half of your contemporaries who did. And of course, they were kind of the first generation where it became substantial. So the point is, first of all, the big headline is a lot of people who are, 20s, 30s, even in their 40s, have used these apps quite a lot. And secondly, for the most part, they're reasonably satisfied. I mean, in the end, it certainly isn't displacing other ways of meeting a partner. But around 1 in 5 of younger people say that they met either their current or their most recent partner via an online event. And that is as many as, say, who have done so via a bar or a restaurant or a party. So, as it were, the online world and the accidental world are now equally powerful in attracting partners, though it's neither is as yet still as common as, I think, where you're closest to, Rachel, and I'm certainly closest to, which is meeting at work or university. About a quarter of younger people say they met that way. So we are now talking about an important phenomenon. And, joking aside, it's clearly an important part now of people's lives and a way in which they form relationship, even if it isn't the only way. And the truth is that most people say, like you, Rebecca, say that, well, yes, I do use a dating app, but I also have met for people for the first time online, etc., etc.
So I suppose what I thought was quite interesting about this is how torn the sample seems to be on whether this is good or not. And when you dive in, it's in some senses for the reasons you'd expect. They think that they meet more people this way. A surprising number seem to think it's sort of less intimidating to meet people online, which I was surprised by, because I thought online...
They've obviously never been interviewed on a trendy podcast, have they?
That's true. It's the first thing I have you. But on the downside, which we haven't talked about so much, it's easier to fake yourself online. You may not look like the person you pretend to be. That's easy to spot when you meet them in person, but you also might not be the person. You might have many other relationships which are easier to get away with if you don't have that social network.
Sure, and indeed, just to underline your point, when people were asked about, whether they would recommend somebody, so we're talking about married people or people in a relationship, and asked them whether or not they think that, they would recommend this as being a better way of finding a new partner, then they're none too sure about that. And more broadly, again, amongst the under 35s, almost as many of them think that, not dissimilarly to Rebecca, that online dating has had a negative impact on what we call dating culture, kinds of things we've been talking about. Almost many think it's had a negative impact, it's had a positive impact. So although there's the satisfaction, although in the end it does work for some people, I guess the way to think about it, I think that, the lesson from this poll is that it's part of a potpourri or a melody of possible ways of meeting people. It's become part of the social fabric of young people's lives, but it's part of the social fabric. It doesn't dominate the way in which they meet people. But it's certainly something that, well, somebody like me, I've learnt an awful lot in preparing for this podcast, because I never thought it would happen. Indeed, I mean, it's still interesting. You can imagine what the reaction of some people of my age might be, though actually it's not that dramatic in the poll, but is there an embarrassment about advertising yourself online? I mean, it's almost do you really need to resort to this? Is, I imagine, what some people would say. And there's an element of that. I mean, again, in our poll, 34% of people say, yeah, there's a sense of embarrassment about doing it this way. 36% said not. That said, there is also one other thing about this that we should mention that I must admit was somewhat surprising. Now, we've got Rebecca on and she's a woman, all right? But the truth is, if we pinch somebody else out of the Tortoise office who was a man, at least our polls suggest, they will be telling a very similar story. Now, there's some work out there, particularly, by the way, in London, Rebecca. There's recently some research published that says, well, you know, it's particularly hard for women in London because there are more women than men in London.
Oh, so, I believe it.
As it were, the marriage market is staked against you. But actually, the interesting thing about this poll is that the answers for men and women are remarkably similar. There are similar levels of satisfaction. They're similar in their probability of having met somebody this way. So I guess, you know, if one felt that men were more uptight about these things and therefore perhaps less willing to advertise themselves, you know, more openly, apparently this is not the case. Now, of course, the answer may be, Rebecca, without my being trying, avoiding being too sexist, you know, maybe at the end of the day, the fact that there are so many attractive and eligible women who do use this service, you know, should we be surprised that men are also trying to meet people that way? But I certainly think it's interesting that what one might regard as, shall we, some of the stereotypes of men of my age of being perhaps more uptight, less openly emotional, all the rest of it, if indeed, you know, that has changed amongst younger men, then maybe this is also reflected in the way they use dating apps.
On the flip side, we know that the combination of being a graduate, because there are more women than male graduates now, and being in a big city, we know that there tend to be more young women in cities than young men, stacks the odds if what you're looking for is marriage against women. And there's been a lot of studies about this in the UK, but also quite famously in the US, where there are all these single male farmers who can't find a woman in the Midwest, and all the women are in, you know, Manhattan or equivalent, and the men in Manhattan have a great time because they have the best ratio
pick of the bunch
going. But the imbalance there does change the dynamics, I would have thought, of dating.
Interesting. And that does check out. I think being in, clearly the message I'm getting from you both is that if I want to find a husband, I must leave London. Is this the message?
We'd miss you too much on the podcast, Rebecca.
Anyway, Rachel, as we get towards the end of these podcasts, we usually throw you, the significant question, which is, so what for public policy? Now, Is there any public policy implications of what we've talked about this morning? Particularly, are there any public policy implications to the changes, at least in the way in which people form relationships? Is there anything here for politicians to meddle with? Or have we found a politician-free subject?
It's a very good question, John. And you suggested one, which is less about online dating, but more about the change in when and how we form relationships, which is that we are much more likely to cohabit now rather than get married. We're much more likely to have children out of wedlock, on the one hand. On the other hand, we tend to have fewer children and older. So the first, I think, the obvious policy question, which we've seen become more prominent, is whether the imbalance in rights between married couples and cohabiting couples can survive a world in which a smaller and smaller percentage of people get married. So if you get divorced, you have rights on property, income, as well as children. If you're cohabiting,
or if you have a civil partnership these days,
or if you have a civil partnership, it's still pretty minimal, the civil partnership in size terms, but absolutely. Whereas if you're cohabiting, you're very much more financially vulnerable if you split up, particularly, again, if you're a woman who is more likely to have dialed down your work to look after the children, you have less of an income, you don't have any rights to the assets of your partner and only really to some form of child support, which is often difficult to get. So does that last? I think that's a big
And that's a continuing debate, because, of course, those people who believe in marriage and who wish to defend it as an institution are saying, and of course, in a sense, the introduction of civil partnerships for mixed-sex couples, although in a sense partly a byproduct of their original introduction for same-sex couples, has meant that for those who are not keen on liberalising the law, they're saying, well, if you object to the religious connotations of marriage, you can just register it as a civil partnership. But it still hasn't stopped, so far at least, the rise of cohabitation, which is, I mean, about a quarter of long-term relationships are now cohabiting relationships.
And I guess the second, which we've talked about in lots of these podcasts, and I think we'll keep coming back to, because I think you and John, you and I agree that this shift in women over the last few decades, their education, their work, their behaviour, is, if I had to pick one, the fundamental social trend of the last 50 years, and it impacts everything.
Yeah.
And one of them is that we have fewer children, like all other countries. This is a sort of global phenomenon. And that means that we are becoming ever older. We have an ever bigger dependency ratio for public finances. We find it unbearable financially if young people remove themselves from the labour market because we have fewer to rely on. And that creates huge amounts of fiscal pressure over the long term. And I think, I mean, I don't want to be fatalistic. I do believe in the power of governments to do things. It's not obvious to me that governments have a lot that they can really do to change this so far. And we are as political people subject to these huge social trends, and we have to adapt to them. It's very hard to change them.
But the implication, therefore, perhaps, is that given that online dating, it's not always satisfactory, but it certainly seems to help some people form a relationship. It's certainly become part, as you said earlier, the medley of ways in which people form relationships. It's perhaps we need to conclude on this podcast, at least, is that perhaps for politicians, it's you just need to allow this to happen, because insofar as the state does have an interest in people forming stable long-term relationships, not least for as providing environment for the bringing up of children, then they probably are, the advice might be to best leave alone, because they're not doing not much obvious in the way of harm, and for some people they're doing good. And so maybe we have found a politician-free area for
I feel the pressure now for the economy to take dating more seriously and to just put up and shut up.
For the country, Rebecca.
Your country needs you, Rebecca.
I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes some of the government messaging over the next few decades, and they're certainly trying it in some other countries with limited success. I suppose we should end on one sort of mildly depressing note, because we've been quite even-handed about online dating. And I think the quality of the studies here are a bit uncertain and they're quite early. But we do have some tentative evidence that people are more likely to break up if they form a relationship or divorce through online dating than through other means, perhaps because of those social connections that we discussed. So I think one of the things we will need to see over the next few decades is whether this has caused a general fragility, or if that is a temporary phenomenon as we adjust to a new world.
I wonder
world.
If it's a bad thing or a good thing, though, because perhaps if you were, you know, if your mum's mums and your cousins and you had family and kids to share, you're in it now. It's very hard to back out. But maybe, you know, I'm here for the chaos.
Maybe make some happening. Here for the chaos, for the individual happiness. All right, well, thank you for turning that into a positive.
And Rachel, by the way, it's usually Rachel who's looking for a positive message towards the end of a podcast, but we've clearly turned it around this week.
John becomes sunnier with every week. I don't know if it's the emergence of spring, but I definitely feel that he's less doom and gloom than he was around Christmas.
It's the upcoming election. This is John's Christmas. It's just arriving.
It's the local elections that's making him so happy. You're so right, Rebecca.
Well, indeed, that's a cue, Rachel. Rebecca, first of all, really thank you very much for sharing your insight and your experience in such an informative and engaging manner. So that's fantastic. But Rachel, I think we need to tell our listeners a little bit about the local elections.
So if, like us, and particularly if, like John, you're interested in how the results of the local elections on May the 2nd might fit into the longer term trends of British politics, and crucially, what they might tell us ahead of the general election, how bad is it going to be for the Conservatives, then you can join us for the first ever Trendy Live on Wednesday the 8th of May.
Yes, we'll be recording That Week's podcast in front of an audience in the Tortoise newsroom. And we'll also be taking your questions. So to be there, go to tortoisemedia.com/book to get your ticket.
But for now, that's it for this episode of Trendy. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis.